Hi, this is Andrew Phillips. Thank you for downloading the Graymere Church of Christ Sermon Podcast. If you have any questions or if you'd like to contact us, check out our website at graymere.com. We'd also love for you to visit with us in a worship service. You're always welcome at Graymere Church of Christ.
Our scripture reading this morning is from 1 Samuel, chapter 25, verses 2 through 8. 1 Samuel 25, verses 2 through 8. I'll be reading from the NIV version. A certain man in Maon who had property there at Carmel was very wealthy. He had 1,000 goats and 3,000 sheep, which he was shearing in Carmel. His name was Nabal and his wife's name was Abigail. She was an intelligent and beautiful woman, but her husband, a Calebite, was surly and mean in his dealings. While David was in the desert, he heard that Nabal was shearing sheep. So he sent 10 young men and said to them, "Go up to Nabal at Carmel and greet him in my name. Say to him, 'Long life to you, good health to you and your household, and good health to all that is yours. Now I hear that it is sheep shearing time. When your shepherds were with us, we did not mistreat them. And the whole time they were at Carmel, nothing of theirs was missing. Ask your own servants, and they will tell you. Therefore, be favorable toward my young men, since we come at a festive time. Please give your servants and your son David whatever you can find for them."
As we've gone through this year, every month we're taking a different passage of Scripture to try to commit to memory and to place in our hearts. If you would, let's think about this month's Luke 6:45. Let's say this together. The good man, out of the good treasure of his heart, brings forth what is good. And the evil man, out of the evil treasure, brings forth what is evil. For his mouth speaks from that which fills his heart. It's an important message for us to internalize and to remember as we go throughout our lives. I hope you've turned to 1 Samuel chapter 25. We're going to be spending some time there as we continue our series on the life of David. And we're going to pick up right where the reading left off in just a moment. But I wanted us to set the stage for what is going to be happening in David's life. I would imagine if we took a poll that no one in this room would want to be considered foolish. We don't want to look foolish. In fact, we go to great lengths to make sure that when we're around other people, we don't embarrass ourselves. And we probably all have stories of things we did that we look back and we regret, or we say, "Well, that was a mistake," or "That just made me look foolish." I can distinctly remember working around a church building during the day one time, getting ready for a big teen event that was happening that night. I was in college, there was no one else in the building, and so I was just sort of singing to myself, and I don't know if you've ever done that before, but there was no one else around, so I was just kind of singing, you know, and just got a couple of songs in my head, those songs that sort of get stuck in your head, and I wasn't really thinking about anything else, and I bounded down the stairs, the bottom level of this fellowship hall, and that's when I realized that I just went right down those stairs in the middle of about 40 ladies and neighborhood group that was meeting together, and I was walking right in front of them. I mean, they were all having this meeting, and I was right there, and they'd, of course, probably heard me singing as I was coming down the stairs. And I had one of those moments where I was just frozen. I mean, I was in such shock, I didn't even have the words to say sorry or excuse me. I just came down the stairs, looked at them, and then just went right back up the stairs. So they were probably wondering who this guy was that just showed up and then ran right back up. But we probably all have stories like that, things that we've done and look foolish. And sometimes those things are silly and they're harmless, but sometimes they're serious. There are some things in our lives we look back on, maybe a chapter in our life or something we did, and there were a series of events that were set into motion because we did something that was foolish. We don't want to be foolish. And as we come to 1 Samuel 25, it's an interesting break in the story of David. That is, we're right in the midst of Saul going after David. In fact, in chapters 24 and 26, we see Saul that he's seeking out David to take his life. And yet, chapter 25 gives us a break there. We're introduced to different individuals in the life of David. And it's important to see why this is placed here and what this tells us. If you look in verse 1 of 1 Samuel 25, right before we get into the passage that was read for us, I think we see something very important. In verse 1, there's one phrase that begins this chapter. Then Samuel died, and all Israel gathered together and mourned for him, and buried him at his house in Ramah. And David arose and went down to the wilderness of Paran. Then Samuel died. Can you imagine what it would be like to be David? To be on the run from Saul and then have the one prophet of Israel, the one who had anointed you, who had served as a judge for all of those years, who had been such a leader, and he was the one who anointed you. He was there. He understood God's will. He was your ally. He was the one that you would go to, and now he is gone. I'm convinced that that has a lot to do with David's actions in this chapter. His main ally is gone, and now David is on the run. He's in the wilderness in more ways than one. It's not just an area of wilderness. He's in a wilderness in his life. Where does he turn to next? Here is someone who is supposed to be anointed the next king, and now he's faced with the crossroads, and he's not sure where to go. And so he and the 400 or 600 or so men that are with him begin doing something that was very common at that time, and that is almost like employees. They would guard individuals who had sheep out in the fields. And so they would guard shepherds in this wilderness area from any tribes that might come through or any bands of thieves that might attack them. And then when it comes time for the sheep shearing, there would be a large banquet. This would be a celebration where all the hard work that went into the sheep shearing was paid off, and it resulted in this time of rejoicing and celebration. And it was at that time that those individuals who had been guarding these shepherds and their flocks would come and expect some reward for their actions. They would expect to be compensated. It wasn't necessarily a law. It was almost like tipping a waiter. It was just something that you did. They deserved it. They had worked for it. And so you would share some of the bounty you had with these people who had been protecting you. And as we go through this chapter, we're going to see three specific individuals that we're introduced to. Three contrasting attitudes. The first is a man named Nabal. And as we think about his description, we read the verses that we just read beginning in verse 2. Just look at the way he's described. His business was in Carmel. The man was very rich. And he had 3,000 sheep and 1,000 goats. And remember, this is a period of time where your flocks indicated the level of wealth that you had. And it came about while he was shearing his sheep in Carmel. Now, the man's name was Nabal, and his wife's name was Abigail. The woman was intelligent and beautiful in appearance, and the man was harsh and evil in his dealings. And he was a Calebite. At this time in history, being described as a Calebite wasn't a tribute to the Caleb that we read about, Joshua and Caleb. By the time we get to this point, it was used as a term of that was derogatory. It's not a positive statement. This man was evil, harsh in his dealings, but he was very rich. He'd be the kind of man today that if he lived in our neighborhood, we would think, wow, look at that house that he lives in. Look at the car that he's driving. Have you heard what he's got inside his house? Have you heard about his setup? Have you heard about the kind of wealth that he has? He was a rich man. And yet his name is actually taken from the Hebrew word that means fool. Isn't that interesting? You have someone who has all the material wealth in the world, and yet when you actually look at his name means fool. There are two different times in the book of Psalms, Psalm 14:1 and 53 in verse 1, where a fool is defined. According to God's terms, a fool is one who says in his heart, "There is no God." And as we read about the way Nabal reacts to this request from David, we see he's living up to his name in more ways than one. He's acting as if there is no God because what he's doing is involved in his own self-centered world, and he is very reluctant to take anything that he's hoarded up and give to anyone else. He's gripping very tightly to the riches that he has. As we continue reading in chapter 25, we see this attitude all over the statement that he makes to David's men. Look at the way that he responds to them after they come to him with this request. Nabal answered in verse 10, "Who is David? And who is the son of Jesse? There are many servants today who are each breaking away from his master. Shall I then take my bread and my water and my meat that I have slaughtered for my shearers and give it to men whose origins I do not know?" This was the culturally acceptable thing to do, was to compensate the people who had taken care of him. He didn't even take the time to question those who worked for him, to ask around and to see if these men were really telling the truth. We find out later that those who worked for him understood very clearly what David and his men had done. And they appreciated it. They were thankful for it. But he doesn't ask them. He's thinking about himself. In fact, if you look at verse 11, it's interesting to see how many times he uses that personal pronoun. Just think about this. "Shall I then take my bread and my water and my meat that I have slaughtered for my shears and give it to men whose origins I do not know?" Do you see how many times that focus on himself comes out? This is all mine. And you're asking me to take something that's mine and give it to someone else? And I don't know these people? He wasn't going to take the time to find out. He was just going to hoard what he had. Have you ever been around someone that enjoyed talking about themselves so much you didn't feel like there were many other topics of conversation? We don't necessarily like being around self-centered individuals, yet if we're not careful, we've all fallen into that trap before, haven't we? To focus on I and me and mine and neglect the needs of other people. It might be a good test for us to think through our conversations. How many times am I focused on myself to the neglect of someone else that's in need? Nabal definitely could have afforded to share some of his wealth, to share some of his bounty with David. And yet he didn't. He was clinging on to it tightly. And the amount of times he uses these phrases, I and mine, is an indication that he wasn't living as if these were blessings from God. Think about how that would change this statement. If instead of saying my bread and my water and my meat, if he understood them as blessings from God, then he would be more willing to share them. But when he understood them as his own, he was going to grip onto them tightly. And so we see that he's living as if there is no God. It reminds us of another description of a fool in the book of Proverbs. Proverbs 28 and verse 26 would say, "He who trusts in his own heart is a fool, but he who walks wisely will be delivered." If we trust in ourselves, if we trust in our resources, we're going to be a fool. If we're looking for this chapter and finding ways that individuals are tempted to play the fool, here is the first one we see, and that is the temptation to live as if everything depends on us, to hoard everything we have, and to have the kind of attitude that's only concerned with ourselves. If I live that way, I'm going to be playing the fool. Because I'm going to be living as if there is no God, as if everything comes from me. And if I live that way, I'm going to look back with regret. And so we see a fool that we're introduced to here. And then we're introduced with a second foolish action. It reminds me of a story that I read a few years ago about a resident of Confluence, Pennsylvania. He came upon something that many homeowners have to deal with at some point in life, and that is, he saw a fierce animal loose in his home. That's right. He found a mouse. He found a mouse that was loose in his home, and if you just look at this picture, I mean, this is just so gentle and so friendly. I mean, could anything be scary about this mouse? And yet he was willing to take action. So he didn't take a broom and try to sweep the mouse out of his house. He didn't take a trap and try to set it. He took his firearm. I don't know if he thought he was a really good shot, or maybe he was just really afraid of mice, but he took his gun and he shot at his mouse, and he missed the mouse, but ended up hitting his girlfriend in the arm. Now, she was taken to the hospital, and the newspaper reported that it was just a minor wound and everything was fine, which, of course, I guess it's minor if it happens to someone else. But everything was fine. The point that they got across at the end in the statement in the paper was they discouraged people from discharging firearms indoors, which was probably a good lesson to learn, but it's not the only lesson to learn, is it? The idea is you're thinking of something that's just a little nuisance, just a little annoyance, and you're taking a big weapon to try to deal with it. That's what happens to David. Here's just a little annoyance, and look at the way that David reacts. When David gets the news, if we continue reading in 1 Samuel 25, look at what happens when they come back to him and report what had taken place. In verse 12, David's young men retraced their way and went back, and they came and told him according to all these words. David said to his men, "Each of you gird on his sword." So each man girded on his sword, and David also girded on his sword. And about 400 men went up behind David, while 200 stayed with the baggage. Now just stop for a minute and consider who is receiving this message. We've been introduced to Nabal. Now we're introduced to David. Now we know what David's done. We know that this is someone who, when he was protecting his sheep in the wilderness, could go up against wild animals. This is someone who had enough trust to face Goliath that no one else wanted to face. This was someone who, even though Saul had sent him into battle for the express purpose of David dying in battle, he was able to defeat 200 Philistines. And yet here's one rich man that says something David doesn't like, and David gets 400 of his men together. What do you think David intended to do with those 400 men? We find out as we continue reading in the chapter. In fact, later on when David is confronted about that, he is very clear that in verse 34, that if Abigail hadn't come to him quickly, he said, "Surely there would not have been left to Nabal until the morning light as much as one male." This wasn't going to be a war. This was going to be an ambush. David was so angry, he was going to take 400 men with him to charge into battle against just one rich man who acted in a way that wasn't kind, and it wasn't the proper according to their customs, and yet it was hardly something that required this kind of response. Have you ever been tempted when there was just something little that happened? Well, just something slight that someone did, or just something someone said that maybe rubbed you the wrong way, and it wasn't that big a problem. But have you ever been tempted just to blow up in anger and to respond in a way that was totally disproportionate to the response that was needed? If you've ever felt that way, then you can relate to how David felt. Now, what's interesting about this reaction is how it contrasts to what we've already seen from David. After all, we have already seen Saul repeatedly try to take David's life. And when David was presented with the opportunity to do the same to Saul, when he was presented with the chance to take Saul's life, he didn't. Because when he looked at Saul, he saw the Lord's anointed. But you almost get the sense that David gets this message from Nabal and he says, "You know, I have to put up with this from Saul, but I don't have to put up with this from him. He's not the Lord's anointed. I don't have to let him do what he wants to do. I don't have to take it from him. I'm going to take action." And again, I wonder how much what we read in verse 1 has played into David's mindset. The frustration and the sadness and the grief of losing Samuel. He wasn't interested in negotiation. He was going to take these men, and he was going to take vengeance himself. Now, when we read in the New Testament, Paul writing to the church at Rome, we're reminded that in Romans 12, 19, he would point back to actually a proverb in the Old Testament, Proverbs 20, 22, that vengeance is the Lord's. The Lord has said, "Vengeance is mine, I will repay." And so, in a way, David is also acting like a fool here. And not just because he's losing his temper, but because in doing so, he is seeking his own vengeance. He is functioning as if there is no God. You see, if I hoard possessions for myself and I don't see them as God's blessing, I'm acting as if there is no God that gave them to me. But if I seek to take vengeance on someone else, if I don't wait on the Lord, if I try to take matters into my own hands, I'm also acting as if there is no God. It wasn't that David didn't believe in God. He was just acting as if he didn't believe the principle that God had stated. And in fact, David had followed that principle with Saul, hadn't he? Hadn't he waited on God every time he'd had the opportunity? He'd have one in 24 and then later on. Every single time he'd waited on the Lord's timing. But here, he makes the mistake of trying to respond in such a disproportionate way. When you've got 400 men and David is saying, gird on your sword, there's no doubt what was going to happen. And so as he goes towards this conflict, we are introduced to our third individual. We're introduced to Abigail. Now in verse 3 that we read in chapter 25, Abigail is described as being beautiful and intelligent. We've been around long enough to know that good character does not always accompany beauty. And yet we see that in the life of Abigail. She's also obviously faithful. And we know that from what she says to David. As we read about her in verse 28, she says, "Please forgive the transgression of your maidservant, for the Lord will certainly make for my Lord an enduring house, because my Lord is fighting the battles of the Lord, and evil will not be found in you all your days. Should anyone rise up to pursue you and to seek your life, then the life of my Lord shall be bound in the bundle of the living with the Lord your God, but the lives of your enemies he will sling out as from the hollow of a sling." That's just a glimpse into the powerful message that Abigail gives David. But I want us just to pause and realize that while we don't know much about her background, we do know that there was a faith in God and that she had an understanding of David's mission. In fact, did you notice the way that last verse ended, verse 29? "If you're facing an enemy, he will sling out as from the hollow of a sling." Now, what does that remind us of in the life of David? Here is someone who was adept at a sling. Here is someone who had won his greatest battle with the sling. And now he was reminded of those words that would have reminded him of what it was like to go up against Goliath. I just wonder how that phrase landed on David as he thought through what was happening. You see, when Abigail comes to David, she reminds him of his mission. Look at how she responds when she hears what's taking place. If we back up just a few verses, when Abigail receives word from her servants in verse 18 of what's happening, she doesn't tell her husband. She says, verse 18, "Then Abigail hurried and took 200 loaves of bread and 2 jugs of wine and 5 sheep already prepared and 5 measures of roasted grain and 100 clusters of raisins and 200 cakes of figs and loaded them on donkeys." That's an amazing peace offering just to sort of whip up at the last minute. She gets all of those things loaded up. And then in verse 19, she said to her young men, "Go on before me. Behold, I'm coming after you." But she did not tell her husband, Nabal. It came about as she was riding on her donkey and coming down by the hidden part of the mountain that, behold, David and his men were coming down toward her. So she met them. Keep in mind, this is not just David and a few of his friends. This is David and hundreds, 400 men. And she goes to meet them. What do you think that would be like? When you've got hundreds of men who are upset and are ready for battle, and here you are and you're going to stand in the way and you're going to try to mediate. And so we see her standing up before them, and look at how she responds in verse 23. "When she saw David, she hurried and dismounted from her donkey and fell on her face before David and bowed herself to the ground." She comes with humility. "Fell at his feet," in verse 24, "and said, 'On me alone, my Lord, be the blame. And please let your maidservant speak to you and listen to the words of your maidservant. Please do not let my Lord pay attention to this worthless man, Nabal, for as his name is, so is he." Remember what his name means. "Nabal is his name and folly is with him. But I, your maidservant, did not see the young men of my Lord whom you sent. Now therefore, my Lord, as the Lord lives and as your soul lives, since the Lord has restrained you from shedding blood and from avenging yourself by your own hand, now let then your enemies be as those who seek evil against my Lord. Be as Nabal." There are a couple of things that Abigail points out to David that I think are useful for all of us when we're tempted to do something that's foolish. The first thing, as David's reacting to this, she tells him to consider the source. She says, "Don't pay any attention to my husband. Don't pay any attention to his actions. She's very blunt about the fact that he's acting like a fool. That don't pay attention to my husband. Folly is with him. He's acting like a fool. Don't let that bother you. And there are times in life when we're struggling with something and someone has said something hurtful to us, or maybe it's an unjust criticism that we want to react to, and it's helpful just to consider the source. Where is that coming from? Maybe there is something I need to address, but let me consider the source. It may be that I don't necessarily need to overreact to something. If I just stop and consider the source. And then she also asks David to consider the consequences. Not just the source of this distress, but consider the consequences. She says, what's going to happen if you take revenge yourself? If you take vengeance on Nabal, and then later on, as you serve the Lord, you're going to look back on that. And as she describes it, she says in verse 31 that if you don't do this, this will not cause grief or a troubled heart to my Lord, both by having shed blood without cause and my Lord having avenged himself. In other words, she's saying, if you do this right now, later on, that's going to cause a troubled heart. Consider the consequences. I wonder how many times we would fall in to sin, or we could avoid falling into sin, if we stopped and considered the consequences. Before we did something, if I really thought through how this was going to affect other people, if I really thought through the impact this would have on my life, she very wisely encourages David to consider the consequences. And in a way, Abigail steps into the role of Samuel. Because isn't this what Samuel has done so far? Anointing David, reminding him of his role, and now he's gone, and it's as if Abigail steps in to fill that gap in David's life. David had done well so far, and yet he slips here. And he's just on the brink of taking vengeance and blood in his own hands, and Abigail steps in and reminds him of his mission. When Paul was writing to the church at Corinth, in 1 Corinthians chapter 10, he was dealing with a people that was struggling with pride. And he was very clear that there would be a temptation to get carried away with their own standing, to get caught up in who had these special spiritual gifts and who had this knowledge and who was really advanced as a Christian. And in verse 12 of 1 Corinthians 10, he would say, let him who stands take heed lest he fall. In other words, if you think you're standing on firm ground, you need to be very careful. David had been standing on firm ground, but he'd slipped and fallen, and Abigail confronts him with that fact. And so we see the wisdom that's there. And then David responds in verse 32, blessed be the Lord God of Israel, who sent you this day to meet me. David looks at Abigail's actions, and he doesn't think it's just one woman's actions. He thinks this is the work of God sending her to meet him. And blessed be your discernment, and blessed be you who have kept me this day from bloodshed and avenging myself by my own hand. David had a teachable spirit. He was willing to stop, to reconsider, to consider the source, consider the consequences, and to change course. Now, when Abigail goes back, by the time she gets to her husband, he's been celebrating the festivities, and he's too intoxicated even to listen to what she has to say. She can't even speak to him about it. And then later on when she does, we read about what happened to Nabal in verse 37. His heart died within him so that he became as a stone. You almost get the sense that he had a stroke. Maybe it was the shock of the story. Maybe it was the anger. Whatever it was, he became as a stone. And about 10 days later, he died, but verse 38 is very clear about who was responsible. David didn't need to take vengeance. The Lord had it in his own hand. The Lord took his life. After that, David sends word to Abigail, proposes marriage. She accepts. And we have in this chapter that's sort of a break in the life of David as he's running from Saul, a very clear illustration of how easy it is to play the role of a fool. And it strikes me that there are two different reactions we see. We see every time we're introduced to Nabal and his reactions, we see him reacting with selfishness, with self-centeredness. He's very obstinate. When we see David react, even though he reacts in a very rash way, when he's confronted with the truth, he's teachable. He's willing to learn. And as we think about our own lives, it strikes me that we have those two options as well. When there's truth that's given to us, we have the choice. We can either be obstinate, we can close ourselves up to it and continue along our path, or we can be open, we can be teachable, and we can be willing to change. None of us wants to be foolish. And the good news is, when it comes to an eternal scale, we don't have to. We have the instruction. We have the kind of wisdom that God has given us. Our choice is, how are we going to react? How am I going to react? Am I going to react like Nabal, or am I going to react like David? And we have that choice even to make this morning. God has made His message plain to us, and the good news of God's Word is that we can choose to be one of His children. We can make that decision to become a child of God. It'll require us turning our lives around. It requires confessing His name, putting Him on a baptism, and living a life that's different than the one that we lived before. But we can make that choice. We can make that choice this morning. Or it may be that there's something else in your life that needs to be addressed, an issue that you feel that needs to be dealt with, or maybe just encouragement that you need. If we can help you in any way, please come forward as we stand and as we sing together.